I would say the biggest issue with, I think, a lot of ideas in general is that they end up being, in cognitive science, there's a name for, I think, one of the things that's in play here, which is it's a phenomenon known as the illusion of explanatory depth.
Have you ever been in a situation where you really wanted to share an idea, but then when you open your mouth, all that comes out is just a jumbled mess of information? And maybe you have shared that idea, and then what you get back are blank stares or nods that are not really an understanding of what you're trying to convey? If so, this episode is for you. Today on Influence Anyone, I'm joined by Tamsin Webster. She's the best-selling author of Find Your Red Thread and Say What They Can't Unhear. She is also a former TEDx executive producer who shaped ideas seen by millions of people. I'm Howie Chan, influence strategist and founder of The Behavioring Company. If you care about your idea, if you want people to really get it and nod along and really remember a succinct and impactful message, this is for you. Let's get into it.
A lot of times people will come in and say, well, here's my idea. And it's a solution in search of a problem. Like, it's not being tied to something. You know, if you think about it, particularly TEDx organizers, we see a lot of ideas.
What is the secret to TEDx presentations that blow up versus those that just fall flat?
Oh, my Lord. Okay, so
what if your team didn't just know more about influence, but actually used it to drive real results? At The Behavioring Company, we help organizations turn brand and behavioral science into a strategic advantage, whether it's turning prospects into fans or employees into ambassadors. If you're looking for a keynote speaker, an interactive workshop, or a full-on strategy sprint, let's talk. Go to howiechan.com/speaking or click on the link in the show notes. Let's make influencing human behavior your company's superpower. Let me see. I'm going to play something for you. Let's see if this works. Okay.
I love lamp. How do you know if your idea is good enough for a TEDx stage? First, does it fall fully within your domain of authority? I remember that.
So you quoted, I believe, Brig Hamlin, played by Steve Carell from The Anchorman. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes, that is correct. Well
spotted. But that was when you were, that was when you were the executive producer for TEDx Cambridge. Tell me about the story of I Love Lamp, Tamsin.
Oh my
gosh. What's going on there?
We were doing a series of kind of promotional videos to release, and I had these short little scripts that I was doing, and they would ask me to say things just to make sure the levels were right or whatever. And eventually, apparently, though, doing enough of these things and also bloopers, that they ended up just adding some kind of like random clip from something I had done to the beginning of it. So one of them, when they were like, oh, we need to check your levels, I was like, I love lamp. And then that made it into the blooper clip of that one. Yeah. Proud of that.
I love that. I love that. No, that was back in May 15, 2017. One of the first posts that you posted.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
It's interesting, that story behind that. It was actually improv. So he said this in improv. It was not in the script. So Will Ferrell basically told him, hey, Steve, why don't you just say something? Just say any random things. And he just started saying, I love lamp, I love curtains or whatever. And then he just went ahead with him like, well, you're just saying everything you're seeing. That's what you're doing. You're just saying what you're seeing. Amazing. Well, I wanted to start with that because, not because of I Love Lamp, but it's a funny thing. But Tamsin, you were an executive producer for TEDx for a number of years. And then you were a strategist, an idea strategist for them for another like 7+ years. So out of all that time, what is the secret to presentations that blow up versus those that just fall flat?
Oh, Lord. Okay. So I can't necessarily give you any kind of guarantee for the blow up part, because that is
multitude of factors.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that is a multitude of factors. I can tell you what will keep something from blowing up. And I will. I'm not going to hold that, keep that secret. And I can tell you what has been more successful than not in getting some of those talks and ideas featured either on TED.com or as an editor's pick for the TEDx YouTube channel, which we've had a bunch. We just wrapped our last event, and it will be my last event for TEDx New England. But our event right before that, we had 8 speakers and 6 of them were selected for as the editor's pick of the TEDx YouTube channel, which was like great. All right. So like I said, the viral stuff, I don't know. That is like YouTube algorithms and all of that kind of stuff. And who knows?
Sure.
But yeah, I would say the biggest issue with, I think, a lot of ideas in general is that they end up being either more generic than people think they are, and probably more accurately, people end up using really generic terminology to try to explain their idea. And so kind of the distinctiveness and the power of that idea, the newness or the novelness of that idea just does not come through in how somebody describes it in the first place. That's often very common. Because I think a lot of times, and I still see this, it makes me sad. I just think a lot of times people just don't do some very basic research to figure out who else has already gone out there with a similar. But the second thing is that, so speaking now about what we tried to always make sure was true about the talks that we did at TEDx Cambridge in New England. So TEDx Cambridge became TEDx New England. We grew up, we got bigger. The other thing we did is we became an exclusively STEM-focused event. So we became exclusively science and social science-focused. And so that was actually, that for me, that was super fun and super challenging because these were, in fact, novel ideas. So we didn't have an issue there, but these were complicated ideas, right? So there are a couple of things that we tried to make sure were always true for our talks. And I would say this carries through to any talk, whether you're interested in, this is true for book ideas and like product ideas and startup ideas. I think all of this is true. So number one, it needs to be the message, quote unquote, about it needs to be complete. And by that, I mean, it needs to satisfy the most basic kind of logic that our human brains need to understand something. And that is causal logic. So the whole idea needs to be both what is the urgent humanity level problem in the case of TEDx ideas that it is addressing, and what in plain English is the distinctive novel solution to that thing. Because otherwise, as humans, even babies, dogs, we operate in causality or in more non-Western philosophies, more stimulus response, right? It's not so linear. But things don't make sense to us if we only have one half or the other. So for instance, a lot of times people will come in and say, well, here's my idea. And it's a solution in search of a problem. Like it's not being tied to something. Or the idea will be, this is a problem. And, you know, if you think about it, particularly TEDx organizers, we see a lot of ideas, not just from what's submitted, but we're constantly scanning. And so when someone's like, this is a problem, 99 times out of 100, we're like, yeah, we know that. And so by being able to
Very generic problem. It's a very generic.
Exactly. And so it's like, okay, but even if you do identify a problem that people haven't seen before, it still needs to be attached to something that people are aware of right now. So I would say before I spend all my time talking about this, that's the most important thing, is that we need to be able to say the whole idea. Right. So that you need to say, for instance, if we want to understand how language works, we need to study the structured associations behind it.
Right.
That's the idea. And again, there's going to be a lot of like science in there that I can't explain, but they can. But that was what we were always trying to do, is be able to get to a clear if then statement. And then to be able to defend it with principles and concepts that people already understood. Right. So that things like associations shape meaning and structure directs attention. And so once people are like, oh, yeah, I get that, they start to understand in principle what the idea is. And so I call those things, based on the work that I've developed, the core claim, the if then. If we want to answer this question, then we take this approach. And then the core case was it added a because in the and. Because this is true and this is true. If we want to solve this, then that. So we would always make sure, and this is still the work I do with my clients, that that is set first because nothing else matters. It can be a beautifully delivered or written piece of content. But if fundamentally people are like, and, or I don't get it, or I disagree, then what are we doing that for? So I don't like to waste effort. So we're like, we're going to figure this piece out first. And like I said, it turns out that's been a remarkably successful approach for the TEDx speakers. But I do a lot of work with startup founders, particularly like climate tech, regenerative agriculture, that kind of thing. Again, really novel ideas, talking to people who don't have the same background. I use the same approach with them, and that's been remarkably successful with them as well.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. I mean, it ties very strongly to the idea of red thread,
your
idea of the red thread, right?
Yes, yes.
So when I was reading it, Tamsin, this thing came to my mind, this quote came to my mind, I'm gonna read it to you quick. The graveyard is the richest place on earth because that's where you'll find the books never written, the songs never sung, the inventions never shared, all because someone was too afraid to take that first step. Now, this is from Les Brown. And it connected with me because it's, I think maybe people weren't afraid of the idea, but they're afraid because the idea wasn't clear in their heads. So they couldn't really push it along and put it out there. It seems like what you're doing is helping people make their ideas real and concrete and to make it in a way that other people can accept and adopt and push it forward.
Yeah. And that, I mean, a lot of times people come to me for the second part and we figure out that the problem is actually with the first part.
The first part.
Yeah. So a lot of times people actually... Many people would say they actually are fairly clear on their ideas. I see kind of two types of people. One group is like, I totally get my idea. It makes total sense to me. I can see that it's huge. I don't understand why it's getting so little attention. And sometimes I think that what's happening is, and I've got a recent way I've been thinking about this, there is something happening in the translation of the idea out of their head and into the space where other people can interact with it. That is just not working. And then sometimes the reason for that is because there is a lack of clarity really about the idea underneath that. But a lot of people, I do have people come to me and say, I've got this and I've got this and I've got this and I've got this and I don't know how to make sense of it for anybody else. So I do that work with folks too. And I was like, oh, okay. I remember this, again, another TEDx example, but I had a scientist who now runs, she does a lot of work on kind of robot teammates and colleagues. And she was like, we've got this line of research and this line of research and this line of research. And in her mind, they were completely separate. I'm like, oh my gosh, they totally make sense together to me. And she was like, oh, I have a whole new way of describing the work of my lab. And I'm like, yay. But what I think happens is, so this is it's a metaphor in process. So the biggest issue is that I think, does in fact have to do with language. And we have to have, almost always, we have to have language. We have to use language in order to get a thing out of one person and into another. And either that's written language or it's spoken language. And while kind of Eastern languages in particular are a little bit better about being more pictographic than just like, they are still, language is still linear. You can only read words in order that they come in the sentence, and you can only hear and process whatever I'm telling you in the order that I am giving you the words.
Right.
So, which is, if we think of that from a linear perspective, it's, my kids will probably be like, Mom, you got this wrong. But I think it's two dimensions. That's two dimensions, right? A line is two dimensions. A point is one dimension. A line is two dimensions. So we've got two dimensions. I have yet to meet any kind of thinking leader. I don't like the word thought leader, but somebody who changes the way people think, a thinking leader. Mm-hmm. I've yet to meet anybody like that who in their mind, their idea is two-dimensional. If I were to describe how ideas and even like the red thread and all my work exists in my idea, it exists as kind of a cloud of things with an infinite boundary where different things swim into and out of attention, but it's all connected somehow, right? Like visually, you've ever seen the visuals of a Wi-Fi cloud going like that? That's what I have in my head, right?
It's like a mind map that I am visualizing too, like a mind map, and things are connecting.
But it's multidimensional and it's shifting all the time and it's colorful and everything's connected. But the only person who can see it in that entirety, even if and even some of it's not going to be clear, is this person, right? And so all of a sudden, the minute we have to explain it to somebody else, we have to take this beautiful, big, gorgeous, like limitless, nuanced, detailed thing that you've been accruing over years in your head for it to make sense. And then you have to give it out to people one word at a time. And that, I think, is the point. That's what happens. It's like, that is hard. And so it makes sense in that perspective, I think, about why it's difficult. I don't think it's any failure of any human. It's just that we're trying to take this almost dimensionless thing and force it into not only something that's linear, but also the thing that makes up those things. Those words mean different things to different people based on whatever context, whatever experiences they're bringing to bear in that moment. So that is a lot to have to account for. And so I'm deeply fascinated by both that problem and how to solve for it. I've been deeply fascinated by it for 25 years. I keep coming back to something like the red thread, because really what you're trying to do is you're trying to give people some edge of that idea where you're almost literally forcing it through the eye of a needle and just giving them one edge of it so that they're continuing to pull it, right? They're engaged, you're feeding it, they're pulling it. So that by the time enough of it gets to the other side, it might be a bit of a jumble on their side, but at least it can now take much more of that kind of, you know, expansive shape than it did on your side. So to me, I know that's very like philosophical, but it's the best I've been able to explain it as to why it's hard and like what we're having to fight against.
Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. What pops up in my head, Tamsin, is it's almost like if I've been creating this dish or making this beautiful dish for many years and I have no clue what the steps are, but I know how to make it. But if for other people to make it, I have to put it in, all right, here are your ingredients. Here's what you need to do for first step, second step, measure this, do that, so that other people can do it too. So I think that's what your red thread formula framework does for people.
That's my hope. Yeah, that was in fact its intent, because in cognitive science, there's a name for, I think, one of the things that's in play here, which is it's a phenomenon known as the illusion of explanatory depth. It sounds very fancy, but it is exactly that thing that happens when you think you know something and then it only takes one or two layers of questions and all of a sudden you're like, I just know it works, or I just know it's right. But you're like, again, you can only defend it or explain it up to a certain point. And then you're like, I don't know. And that's problematic, of course, if you're actually trying to explain this beautiful thing to somebody else. And all of a sudden, you yourself are suffering from this. Your explanatory depth is not deep, right? So the red thread was really trying to give people a scaffold, essentially, to say, figure these things about your idea. If you can figure out, like, what is that question it answers? What's the kind of unexpected, unseen problem that's getting in the way? What is the kind of the big realization that someone's going to have? What actually is the thing that you're asking them to do differently? By forcing, like, stepwise, that just figure this piece out. Okay, now figure this piece out. Oh, and then, hey, presto, if you put them in order, it's going to, A, make sure that you've got, like, the minimum viable explanation of your idea. And it means that you've got something to hold and hang all of those kind of beautiful aspects of the idea that are sitting in your head, but in a way that's actually digestible by somebody else, right? So that they can handle it. Yeah, I sometimes in my head, back to the cooking metaphor, I sometimes describe it as that big, beautiful idea is like a huge bowl of spaghetti, right? And then we're essentially, a lot of times what we do is, here, eat it in one bite. And it's like, you can't, right? Like, you can only give people like a noodle, Lady and the Tramp style, right? And so that's all you can hope for. But that was my intent with the red thread. It's the intent with the work that I do now, which is like there's a core of the red thread that like sits underneath it. I like to call it the core case. And it's the same thing. They're all still getting at this thing that makes things make sense. And both the red thread and the core case, I call it the ITBA, if then because and, are essentially externalizing proxies for the mental models we use anyway to make things make sense, right? So the red thread is story structure. We use the mental model of story structure to get an understanding of kind of temporal things. How do things happen? In what order? Why? How? Etc. And then the ITBA, the core case, is a proxy for our mental model of reasoning. In other words, what is it? How do we decide something is true or right? And so by understanding both of those, and by being able to answer the questions that allow you to fill in those structures, you're able to answer, I think, at least to start with, 90% of the explanation that most people struggle with right now. And then the last 10% is the easy stuff, because that's the detail mm-hmm. you're very happy to talk about anyway.
So, Tamsin, anyway, folks who are listening should definitely go get the book, dive into the scaffold, the steps, fantastic examples. To give people a taste of what this is, Tamsin, can you walk us through what is this scaffold? How can folks grapple and untangle that big noodle, if you will, into something digestible?
Okay. Yeah. So there's five elements of the red thread: a goal, a problem, a truth, a change, and an action. And the place to start always, and the core case starts in exactly the same place, is with the goal. Now, what's really critical here is this is not your goal as the person who's trying to make this make sense to somebody else. This is the person you're talking to. Something, and one way to think about it is something they want. In other words, you got to figure out, of all the ingredients in your dish, which is the tastiest one to put forward. And almost always, that is I like to call it a persistent irritant, right? It is something that is, they're always open to finding a better answer for it. Always, always. And they haven't found a good answer yet, or else they're not going to be looking for yours. So that can be anything from, like, how can we raise the probability of success of our sales conversations, to how can I get the mental energy that I need, to what is it about other brains that require sleep? That's one of the ones from TEDx.
How do you know when you have a good one? How do you know when you've landed on a good goal?
Yeah. So I think it's, and honestly, we've got a lot of tools now that help us better. The rise of generative AI is actually really useful when you want to say, hey, this is my topic. What are the 10 most common questions you're getting about this right now? And that's it. One of the things
is a good prompt. Yeah.
It's a good prompt. And a couple other tests that I typically run my clients through is, number one, we want to get it as low on Maslow's hierarchy of needs as we possibly can. Meaning we want to get it away from how can you be your best self to how can I,
what is the most painful, or what is the most like visceral.
That's exactly. What's the most visceral thing that they are aware of? And that's really key, because we've been, I gotta say, Hallie, we've been fed a line of crap about, you've got to lead with what the real problem is. And it's okay, only if the people that you're reaching know they have that problem, or else there's no way they can figure that you are talking to them.
Yeah, so, and it's a long journey to get them to realize that.
And who's got that time? I don't know.
Nobody.
Time.
Yeah, they're like, next.
So when I'm talking about this in keynotes or workshops or whatever, I say, the way to think about the goal is as the initial songs of any Disney movie is what musical theater buffs would know as the want song. So I grew up, this is dating me, but I grew up in like Beauty and the Beast and Little Mermaid, and they had very clear want songs. Like, I want more than this provincial life. That's
Yes.
I want to be where the people are. That's Ariel. And so I think that helps people understand that, again, to them, that's a problem. They believe they are experiencing that problem, and they are smart, capable, good people that are trying to solve it when a new problem comes into play. And generally that new problem comes into play because there's something about how they've been trying to solve the problem that's a little misguided. So the real problem is not the provincial town, right? That's not actually the problem. And the real problem is not that Ariel doesn't have legs, right? But it's because they believe that's part of the solution that gets them into even worse trouble, right? When they're trying to do it. And that's what the problem is in the red thread. It's essentially saying, this is an important question, full stop. And we're choosing it because nobody will do anything, will make any change unless at some really deep level they consider what's necessary to make that change worth it. So that's part of why we try to get that question as like visceral and persistent and urgent, as important as we can, because we don't want them to unwant it in the midst of this. So we start there. But the real problem that we introduce later is to say, hey, listen, you're a good person, right? You've been trying to solve this. And it makes sense that you've been trying to solve it in this way. Except there's something about how the world works that doesn't allow that to be a fully satisfactory answer, right? So just even if I'm talking about this whole process of building buy-in for ideas, a lot of people are like, well, I need to make sure that it's understandable. And I'm like, yes, true. But if we don't have agreement on the idea, nothing's ever going to happen. So as much as understanding is critical, like agreement is actually even more critical if we're trying to ensure that somebody does something with it, right? So again, you're not wrong for looking for understandability, but if we go for understandable and agreeable, now we're in for something, right? And yeah, you're going to give people some tools to say, well, how do we get agreement? I'm going to say that's through the structure of argument. Great. So now we feel like now we're ready to give them a solution. No, we are not. And this is one. So this is one of my favorite moments, because I have yet to see any other universal or attempting to be universal story structure other than Aristotle, who came up with it, that talks about this next moment. And yet it is critical for change. And so Aristotle, the creator of the three-act structure of story, spoke about every story of change, every story of transformation has in it what he called the anagnorisis. And what that means, roughly translated from the Greek, so I understand, is recognition or realization. And it's the moment where the protagonist doesn't just have to be a hero. Don't even get me started on that. Where the main character has a realization, recognizes the true nature of their circumstances. Mm-hmm. In other words, there's one other big aha. Not only, oh my gosh, I've been going about this all wrong, but another, oh my gosh, because this is true, the only way now for me to actually succeed is to do this instead. And that is where what I call the truth. We have to give people some additional piece of information. And it is not just data. It is principle of how the world works, or it's just some fact of life. That means now we have to do something different. And that truth immediately creates, it forces, as I say in the red thread, in French, a red thread, it forces a choice. Because the moment you say, yes, that's true, or oh my gosh, this is what's true, something prior in the journey is now at deep risk.
Hey, quick break here. What Tamsin is about to share is one of the most powerful belief and behavior shifting examples in modern persuasion. And here's the thing, examples are great, but what is actually behind these influential ad campaigns or messages that's out there? It turns out there are behavioral truths, there are levers, and there are proven methods that underlie all of them. And that's why I built a free 7-day email course, as well as an AI coach to help you apply these behavioring principles. You can grab it free at howiechan.com/behavioring or click on the link in the show notes. 6 core truths, 5 influence levers, 65 proven methods in your inbox. All right, let's get back in, because this example is about to help you understand why this is crucial.
So my favorite example, and I use this one in the book because most people are familiar with it, is the best truth statement I've ever heard is De Beers's decades-old tagline now of a diamond is forever. And again, people have different opinions about diamonds now and all of that, but we have to think back, right, to when that tagline came out, which was 1947, when engagement rings were not common, diamond engagement rings were not common, and De Beers was the monopoly holder on diamonds, and they wanted a lot more people to be buying diamonds. So if we go back and reconstruct and say, okay, well, what is a persistent irritant, right? Like that is always there that potentially diamonds could be assault for. And I would say it could be, we could frame it as something like, what's the best symbol of our forever commitment? Or even just the commitment, like we two who are getting engaged.
Right. How do we show that?
How do we symbolize? How do I symbolize this commitment to ourselves and the world? Okay. Real problem, which is made really clear by the introduction of the truth statement. But the issue is mostly from De Beers's perspective that people were just seeing the ring as a symbol, right? Hold up. It's a something without beginning and without end. That is a perfectly good symbol of forever, except not for De Beers unless it had a diamond slapped on it, right? But so what they were trying to get people to see from their point of view, the problem was that people were using a too limited of a definition of, or were focusing only on the ring as a symbol and not seeing anything else about the ring being potentially a symbol too. Enter their tagline, a diamond is forever. Notice, it does not say a diamond ring is the best way to show your love. It does not say buy a diamond. It just says a diamond is forever. And for most intents and purposes, that is literally true. It is literally true. Again, I always joke that engineers like argue with me. I know, destroy one, it's possible. But for most people, they're like the hard substance, really hard to
destroy.
Think
about it as the perception of the hardest substance on earth. And
so you're like, that's true. Like part of you might be going, but you're like, oh, that's true. So if that's true, that a diamond is forever and you want the best symbol of your commitment and you've only been paying attention to the ring, you could look at it as if you don't put a diamond on it, what are you saying? Or I think this is what they're hoping for. You can essentially double down on the forever. We're going to put a forever diamond on a forever ring and woo. Mm-hmm. And so the shift, right, which was humanity level or at least Western culture level, was the stone is the symbol, not just the ring. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about. The truth is, it's the principle, it's the idea, it's the belief that a diamond is forever. And they do a beautiful job because it's something that is literally true that in context becomes metaphorically true. And that's, oh, this is great. And so then that leads to that change, right? Which is the shift that, and again, it needs to be articulated specifically what it is. And that shift is, we're going to go from the stone, from the ring being the symbol to the stone being the symbol. And then the actions are, well, how do you put that in play? Well, you buy the diamond ring. And that brings you all back to the beginning. What's the best symbol? Well, now you've gone through that whole journey. And now you've got the best symbol by slightly shifting what you're focused on. And that is not only something that makes sense to people because it includes those kind of principles of, all right, a stone can be a symbol too. Like the kind of ring can be just as symbolic as the ring itself, and that a diamond is forever. By introducing that, you're able to really, again, you're just filling in the blanks that somebody's head would be trying to fill in anyway to give themselves essentially the story they can tell themselves, to give them the rationalization, the rationale quite literally for why they now either want to give or want to receive a diamond ring. And so that's what we're trying to figure out with any idea, really, is not like, how do we get people to like buy diamond rings? It's about saying, what were the principles that brought you to believe that this and only this was the best answer to that? So that's what we're trying to get to. And then the actions are just, again, that's the detail. Everybody knows that part. That's your 5-step framework or that's your product line or whatever. And then as a bow on it, you can always go back to the goal and say, hey, I know you just walked in wanting this one thing, like to get out of this provincial town. But now don't you see that not only have you gotten that, but you've gotten so much more. And that's, you can almost hear it. It's like, well, that would be a beautiful sales pitch too, wouldn't it? Turns out, yes. So those are the elements. So goal, that's something the audience wants and doesn't yet have. An unforeseen, unpredicted problem that gets in the way. A realization, a moment of truth that forces a choice. The change that results. Again, it's going to be a change either to give up that goal. Unlikely. We've worked hard to make sure they're not going to, that they're going to unbelieve something that they have generally believed to be true, or easiest thing for them to do, shift their focus from, let's say, the ring to the, or from legs to love, like in Ariel's case, the actions to make that change real, and then sum it all up at the end by saying, hey, what else do you get from doing this?
Tamsin, that's such a beautiful arc. It seems like the truth, the moment of truth, is really like the secret sauce, the bridge between problem and solution.
It is. Oh my God. Yes, Howie. And it is shocking how often it's left out. Where we just presume, because it's so obvious to us.
It's so obvious. If I say this problem, of course that's a solution.
Of course that's a solution. I'm like, it's not obvious, right? It isn't obvious unless you make it explicit. And so this whole line of like, why isn't it obvious? Literally, it's what took me into my doctoral program, because I was like, what? And the place I could never have expected to land, it makes sense now looking backwards, was actually in argumentation. Again, it makes sense. So what folks that are experts in argument are all about, which is built on reasoning, which is built on Aristotle, so it all comes back, is that sitting underneath, whenever you say this, anytime you make that kind of claim, this does that, you know, if then, that sitting underneath that, almost always unexpressed, is something known as a warrant. So think search warrant. Essentially, it's a justification. So again, you can think of a search warrant as you have to have justification in order to be able to search somebody or somebody's house. So the justification is, it always sits right underneath, right? So I remember I was working with a client one time and she's like, I just want these realtors that I'm working with to understand that there's way more opportunity in marketing to people over 50 than people under 30. And I was like, okay, why do you believe that? And she said, well, because there's more people over 50. Now that's data. But do you start to feel like you can almost feel it, right, Howie, where you're like, but why does there being more people over 50 mean that someone would be able to sell more?
Right.
The underlying, and so that kind of principle that sits underneath, which most of us have never been, I didn't even know what they were called. I didn't even know they were there. Didn't know what they're called. So I certainly wasn't trained to like look for them. But once you know to look for them, you see them everywhere. Because underneath that is this kind of principle that the more people there are, the more people you have to sell to. But if you just say, well, you should sell to these people and stop there, they're going to be like, why? You say, because there's more of them, some of them will intuit what that might mean, but some of them are going to be like, and? But if you're like, the more people there are, the more possible sales there are, they're like, oh, and all of a sudden,
yeah, it's like spelling out the obvious. Yeah, it's like spelling out the obvious. Then that becomes, like you said, the warrant, the bridge, the thing to for them to agree to then take the change.
That's right. You could even think about it back into like Machiavelli, right? When people talk about the ends justify the means, that's an if then, right? The ends justify the means. And we just skip over the whole justify part. And I'm like, whoa, because very few means in and of themselves justify the ends. The justify is where all of the action happens. And that is, we just skip right over it. And so—
Is it always a universal truth, Tamsin? Or is it a truth to the audience, like specific to the audience?
Yeah. So I think it's got to be something that the audience agrees with. Yeah. And so I have found that the more universal we can make it, the more powerful it is. And there's three reasons. Number one, it doesn't trigger any kind of, wait, that's not true, or I don't believe that. It doesn't conflict. It doesn't immediately conflict with some kind of pre-existing belief. And so you expand your opportunity to just have a dialogue a little bit longer because someone's like, okay, diamond is forever. Yeah, yeah. Keep going. Second, the more universal it is, the more likely it is that you're able to articulate it in words and concepts that other people understand and don't misinterpret. Because everybody understands the basic nature of what goes up must come down.
Right.
It's hard to get that one wrong. Whereas opposed, if you talk about authenticity.
Yeah. Oh, so many, different ways to slice and dice it. There's baggage around the term.
Yeah. So this is what, and then the third thing that it does, and I'll get back to this in just a minute, is that it's more likely that more people will have common ground with you if you're able to explain it in terms that they already understand, they already agree with. Okay. Next question is often like, where do you find them? The best sources for them are almost always, in my experience, are almost always like axioms of science and math. And that may sound scary, but like, again, we don't even realize how many of these we just take in and accept. But they can also be industry specific, right? They can also be like, again, it just needs to be far enough down in that universality where you're not, where you're below triggering beliefs like politics and religion, and you're above what are known as primal beliefs, which are pretty dichotomous and not resolvable quickly. Like, for instance, there's people who fundamentally believe the world is a beautiful place, and there's people who believe the world is an ugly place, and that is not a debate you're going to solve quickly.
Right.
So as long as we're in between. So an example, I was working with my publisher, but also my client, Page Two, and they wanted to use a term that a lot of publishers use, which is, we believe in partnership. And I'm like, partnership is like authenticity. And I was like, you can only do that if you define it your way. And what we got to was that for them, partnership was the equal exchange of expertise. Now it's super clear what that is and what people can expect. And once they've said it out loud, now any future time that they say partnership, people can now attach that meaning to it rather than whatever they would fill in on their own. But this is why I am like so obviously passionate about why we've got to get these, we've got to get these justifications out, because the world is...
And is the truth for that, Tamsin, some like two minds are better than one, like this idea of...
Oh, yeah.
The one plus, yeah.
I mean, because what it allows is... Well, that, absolutely. So I do this work also with teams, right? And so for organizations trying to figure out not only how to talk about a new strategy, but what the new strategy should be. And when you're in this process of creating this rationale, this kind of mental story together, you are creating a shared mental model of this. You are deciding together why it makes sense. And you are surfacing the principles and the assumptions and the beliefs that the group agrees is true, which invokes something that, you know, again, has a fancy name for it, but it's known as collaborative reasoning. And over again, the science is clear that while there are exceptions to this rule, almost always a group of people will come to a better or more accurate conclusion than any single person would have come to on their own. And so that's part of it. And the other part of it is that by having this as a discourse, as a dialogue, it forces that explanation piece to come out, right? So it forces that awareness of where we're suffering from that illusion of explanatory depth, because all of a sudden people were like, clearly this is the right answer. And if someone was like, well, I don't agree, now with this as a scaffold, instead of trying to just go like out data each other, we can say, well, back up. Like, why does that data mean that to you? And then it becomes much less tense to be talking about the functional principles, right? Again, how does it actually work? Why would this work? Tends, based on my observation, I'm very curious about this. It's a future research project, but it tends to depersonalize it. It tends to take a lot of the emotion out, because you're not talking about who's right and who's wrong. You're basically saying, based on what we agree to be true about the world, how can we make this make sense? Like, why does it make sense to me so I can make it make sense to you?
It gives it the structure for you to argue upon, as opposed to a amorphous mess that you're trying to figure out who is saying what.
Or the kind of like the total data dump. Because what I see is we tend to err on one side or the other, right? We tend to err on the side of data and rationality and analytical and all of that. That makes sense. There's a whole part of our brain that's dedicated to that. It's the kind of the more evolved kind. The only problem with it is that it's slow, because it takes a lot of time to do that.
And effort,
And the thing is that, as we talked about before, if anything that I say triggers your shutdown because of the order that it's coming out, it doesn't actually matter, right? If at the end of it, you might have gone, oh, fine. But if you heard a conclusion, or you heard a piece of data, or you even that data was bought from somebody or some organization you don't trust, boom, done. Like, it doesn't matter. The other thing we do is we swing entirely the other way. And as much as I'm a fan of story, this is a lot of where it comes in. People are like, oh, just tell a good story and it'll be great. Mm-hmm. I'm like, no, it doesn't work that way. Because we tend to do one of two things in that standpoint is we either tend to tell like a beautiful, great vision of a story, which is great. We want that to happen. The negative is when we get somebody so like infomercials are great. Example of this, right? Where you're like, oh my gosh, I want to look like that. I want my car to be that clean. I want the state. I want the, what is it? The slap dropper. Like I want to be able to make salads that quick. And then you get it and you're like, what the hell was I thinking? Right? Because the moment that you're no longer in that kind of irrational space, like eventually your analytical brain does take back over and it's like, oh. And the reason why that's such an issue is that these two processes, this analytical process that we have in our brain and that automatic brain, they work at the same time, right?
Right.
So if you get people all fired up or scared and we're trying to like the pain of the status quo has to exceed the pain of change and you're like, then what that does is it literally shuts down that analytic process and that person cannot make a rational decision in that moment. Now, you might say, and there might be people who are like, well, that's exactly what I want. And I'm like, okay, not how I like to live my life. You do you.
For the short term, it might be okay. But then for the longer term, right. Like but you said, once again, you receive the thing and you'd be like, what the hell is this? You just put me in this state to buy this thing. And then now I got it. And it sucks.
I think no that's where a lot of buyer's remorse comes in or where a lot of ghosting comes in, where you get a salesperson who's really good in the moment and they get that person to commit. And then afterwards, that person sits with that experience and they're like, well, either, wait a minute, I can't actually explain to somebody else now why we should do this. And so if I can't explain it to somebody else, then I'm going to be the one that they look at as to what went wrong. So, this is also part of my purpose in life, is that they start to think about what was done to them in order to have felt that way.
And right.
I think increasingly we start to recognize when people are like, so tell me what keeps you up at night. Or like, you know, the questions you're like, oh, dude, you're going to try to turn this into a sales pitch.
Right. It's coming. You know it's coming.
You're like, it's coming. You're like, because they telegraph it. And you're like, and that starts to shut people down, too. So part of where I've been going with my most recent work was trying to figure out, like, how do we, because it seems like an impossible problem, right? If you speak only to one side, the analytical side goes down. But if you speak to the analytical side, the other side might reject because it violates a belief. And if either one of those things happen, again, back to your original question, that's going to shut down and keep something from being listened to, opened up, considered for virality or whatever. So everything I'm so fascinated by is like, just how do we keep that window of willingness open a little bit longer? And it really comes down to, frankly, transparency in a really weird, like in almost, what we're making transparent are things that are typically implicit because we're not even aware of them. And we are using this combination, it sounds paradoxical, and it is in a way, of belief-based logic to make it all work, at least for like to go, this is the big picture. Let me just give you this idea. We want to build buy-in. We need to use belief-based logic because people act on arguments that they agree with, and the arguments they agree with that most easily are based on beliefs we already have. So therefore, belief-based argument, right? And you're like, that's the picture. And then if there's something in there that they disagree with, they're going to tell you, right? They are. Or they're going to be curious and they're like, okay, well, tell me more. And now, to paraphrase Seth Godin, instead of doing permission marketing, we're essentially doing permission persuasion, right? We're saying, I'm not holding anything back. I obviously am here because I believe in this idea. I obviously would love for you to agree with me. I'm going to put all my cards on the table and say, I believe that the whole reason I believe this is A, if you do this, it will get this thing that I'm pretty sure you care about. And the reason why I believe it works and you can start to understand why it might work as well for you is because it operates with these principles that you already understand to be true. So if we can work from there, well, now we've got an opportunity to say, all right, if we've got an issue, where is it? How do we resolve it? Can we resolve it? If it all sounds good, how can we now proceed down the path of adding detail, adding that kind of additional information that really is required for someone to, particularly a business, to invest in something different or new.
Tamsin, I do want to touch on Say What They Can't Unhear, your newest book.
Yes.
But before that, I'm super curious. Again, there was this post that you had where you had a picture of a handwritten note where you used your framework to write a note to yourself, which is, I think it's about fear and baby steps.
Oh.
So you wrote down,
Yep.
The goal, the problem, the truth, like all of that
yep.
in a note. So do you still use that as a way to write notes?
100%. I still do. And I still also either start with one of my frameworks or the other. But that note was like, I will still, when I'm recording my videos and things like that, that's how I will structure the video. Because again, it's story structure is the most understandable form of delivery to people for kind of understanding that includes the possibility of mind change, right? That rationale at the heart of it, though, it can be hard to build that narrative structure if you don't know that piece. And so that was kind of the big lesson I learned after publishing the first book, was where people were struggling was on the principle that made the problem a problem and the truth. And well, guess what? Those two principles are the two premises of the argument for why, if you want that goal, you need to make this change. It's because there's something about this, what you've been doing, that isn't going to get there. And there's this other thing that is true that is going to indicate why. So you've been focusing on the ring, but the kind of ring can be symbolic too. Diamond is forever.
Yeah.
It's because that's true and a diamond is forever. If you want the best symbol, then buy a diamond ring. So that's the rationale version of it. But the story version, yeah. So I still use it also to clarify. And when and since I've been in school, I will also do it to summarize the argument of a theory or of a paper. Because essentially, we don't even realize it, but we do this all the time, right?
Yeah.
And so just being able to get something down to its most accessible components. I'm very careful not to say they're not necessarily simple, because they're not. Nobody's going to say that gravity is simple, right? Or that momentum is simple, but it is a straightforward, accessible concept.
It's a straightforward thing and easy to understand. It's there available right. for you to grasp.
And again, like, we only need to go as deep as is necessary for the other person to have enough information to be able to proceed with confidence. And so, yeah, so I still do it, because I think the only reason why anyone does anything or studies anything or comes up with anything is to solve some of their own problem. And so, yes,
that's
absolutely.
Right. Scratch your own itch.
That's right. Exactly.
All right. So let's get into your latest book, Say What They Can't Hear. It's Principles About Change. I'm super curious again. Is it because you realized that the last two parts, change and action, is like the most important part of delivering this and how it comes about?
Well, it was yes and. So that's part of it. And it was also multi-directional, right? And it was still reacting to some extent to the idea that people, I think, want to think that data or story is the answer to everything. Everyone's just like, well, you just need to tell a story. And I'm like, okay, so much that is good about a story. But if, you know, a story is in every way just an argument in disguise. Right. There's a great book called The Ancient Art of Thinking for Yourself, where she uses this example. It's perfect. But depending on how you tell the series of events of Britney Spears's life, right, that can either be a story of a caring dad, of a mentally unstable but very talented woman trying to do his best to keep her safe. It can also be told as exploitative father taking advantage of the daughter in order to like keep his place in the world very secure. Depending on which details you focus on, the events don't change, but the angle
how
you
piece
give on
it
them,
together,
how you
right.
piece it together does. And so this is the point I try to make with everybody, which is the story isn't enough. If you are trying to tell the exploitative father version to a group of people who, based on what they already agree to be true and whatever, are convinced of the other version of it, you're all done, right? So this is where it was part of that idea. Second, I still see so many people try to achieve what they say is change, but in my mind can only be short-term action, by really, I'm just going to call it like it is, manipulative, deceptive, and coercive tactics. I get super mad about people using psychological tactics against people without their knowledge. And a lot of that is just baked in to a lot of sales language in particular, a lot of marketing, and I'm not cool with that. At least I don't want to perpetuate it. I don't want people to keep doing it simply because they don't understand that there are, in fact, not just viable alternatives, but that are actually more successful long term than what they've been doing now. Because back to what we were talking about, the thing is, like, people are increasingly aware of these techniques, right? And that leads to what psychologists call persuasion knowledge, meaning they have knowledge of the persuasion that is being attempted upon them. And for many people, that feels like you are trying to take their agency and their control of the decision away. Mm-hmm. And that triggers another thing, which is called reactance, which is another kind of form of resistance, which means that people will do anything, including saying no to something they would have otherwise said yes to, in order to regain that feeling of control. So when you are using persuasion knowledge, even when you're using those tactics, if somebody recognizes them and doesn't like them, right, which those aren't very big ifs, frankly, because increasingly people recognize them and nobody likes them. Not only does it set the seeds for the future failure of whatever you may have been able to coerce them into doing, but second, it weakens their trust in you because they know that you've been trying to do this. And if there's one universal truth of sales, is that people buy from people that they know and trust. Well, A, you've just given trust a big old whack at the knees, and they don't like people that do that either. So you've also just, you've got two strikes. So it just, I wrote that second book because I just wanted to get like some of these other ideas out there, like very well supported, very well researched, very supported by evidence, science, but also our own experience about what it takes for someone to, you know, what I've seen a recent author, Dr. Richard Boyatz, is called sustained desired change, like change that lasts, change that's internally motivated, something that isn't just done once. I have a difficult time, I'll admit, squaring the ethical argument for these manipulative techniques, but I really don't understand how it makes sense economically either, right? I've got an MBA. I understand how money works and how we're supposed to like make money as companies. I don't understand, like, again, universal truth of business, what's more expensive, recruitment or retention?
Right.
Recruitment. What's more expensive, acquisition or retention? Acquisition. So don't acquire people, don't recruit people through means that are absolutely going to interfere with your ability to retain them. Like, it just doesn't make sense to me. You're going to close more, you're going to close better. You're going to find better alignment, better long-term alignment by following some of these principles than the stuff that's out there. So that was a lot of like my fired up, stand on a soapbox reason to write that book, because I was just like, I wasn't seeing anybody else talk about these things, at least in this context. And I was like, listen, like if whether you're talking about TEDx or you're talking about like my 13 years moonlighting as a Weight Watchers leader and doing this work for companies and businesses, if I know anything, I have a pretty good understanding of what's required for long-term change, or at least what's required in the communications that are more likely to create the conditions for it. Again, I know what's going to stop it in a second. At the very least, I wanted that book to get out there so people could say, all right, I may not be able to guarantee that your change is going to be successful or that your pitch is going to be successful. I can guarantee that I can keep you from making it unsuccessful in the first 90 seconds. And so that, if nothing else, like you just give me 90 seconds of possibility and you can do a lot with that, with it's a really good idea. And even if it's not, but if it's just the right idea for the right person at the right time, and you know how to explain that, then you can make a huge impact in a very small amount of time.
Tamsin, I totally agree with you. I feel like we've gotten to the point of when you're forcing someone to do something that they're not willing to do, it's going to come back to you. And I think all the experts that I talk to, it's 100% right. You might not know what the tactic is, but you'll always remember the person or the brand or the company that did it to you, and you're never going to go back. It's just the truth. And I think, you know, your work, I think even on the red thread, it makes it that much more explicit that you are solving a problem that already exists. You're not manufacturing a problem that they're wanting to solve. So You want to help people. I mean, that's why you start by helping someone and being explicit about what you're helping them with.
That's right. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I would say that based on all the years I've been doing like marketing and sales and change communications, that there's three things that are really hard. Four things. One, getting people to want something they don't currently want. That's probably the easiest of them. Second, to get them to unwant something they currently want.
That's very hard. Yeah.
And the thing is, a lot of time we're trying to get somebody to want something which requires them to unwant something in the process,
something else.
And that's not going to happen. To try to get someone to believe something they don't believe, also very difficult and nearly impossible to get somebody to unbelieve something that they already believe. And yet, huge amounts of what is taught and what is common practice, I'm not even going to grace them with the best practice, just is asking people to do that, is asking leaders to do that, or salespeople to do that, or marketers to do that. And then people wonder why it takes so much time. And I'm like, And so both of the red thread and all my work starts from the perspective of, well, remove the obvious points of friction. Just my dogs, you can see some of their paws going up in the background. They've taught me that lesson that like dogs and humans both, there's two things you can always count on, that they're going to want to keep doing what they already want to be doing. Right. And they're going to want to stop doing what they don't want to be doing. And that is true of humans, too. So both of these things start with, let's start with what people are already looking for and what they're already curious about. So back to your question about like finding a goal question. We also want to start that question as close to what you can actually help with as is believable. So I was working with a client, they're a software as a service. And I was like, what's the goal? And they're like, grow your business. And I'm like, with data formatting software? You know, and all I have to do is say that. And they're like, but we're also always supposed to tie it to revenue. I'm like, there's a lot of if-thens that have to happen between your software.
It's very far.
And so by the end of it, we were like saying, listen, you have to start again with this, you know, what people can actually believe. I don't even know I've said that yet. Not because you tell them, but because it just, again, they can intuit or they could start to see why it might work. And so with that client, we went from how can you grow your business to how can you make your data more usable so that this can happen.
Something
that
you can
happen
own.
That
yeah,
can, so
something
again,
you can own. Yeah.
So when they say, well, it's context-based formatting, now you can start to go,
makes
sense.
Yeah.
But if you just said, hey, that's not girl formatting, it's going to grow your business. You're going to be really like, what? And so that's also part of it. But it's also why finding kind of both sides of that if then that we were talking about before is so important, because it helps you do even just a real quick gut check. Because guess what? Your audience is going to do that themselves, whether or not those two things even make sense together. And so, ultimately, like I said, I could talk about this for hours. Obviously.
Tessa, I'm going to ask you about your favorite or at least the most critical principle. But before you do that, as you were talking about this, it reminds me of this entire phase of purpose marketing where people are trying to match what they do to this like ridiculous huge purpose, which is again that mismatch, right? Like everybody's trying to save the world. Everybody's trying to do this huge thing. And then what do you sell? Ball bearings? What does it have to do with saving the world? I think that's a huge miss there. Yeah.
So again, it's well-intentioned. So I like to try to give people credit. So the thing is that it is interesting, right? I mean, so bless Simon Sinek and start with why, and everyone's like purpose-driven. Because people weren't oftentimes even including the if you want this other thing, this. That said, I don't know that he put the believability boundaries on it, right? That's part of it. And it's not just him, right? But the other thing where, you know, particularly more of the evidence-backed kind of folks that focus on purpose is that there is good science and research empirical research that says that changes that are and organizations that are based in a forward-looking, clear and compelling purpose are more durable changes than something else. So, which is great. And life, like real life happens, right? And so I'm a fairly practical person. One of the work that I've always been doing is trying to figure out how do you operationalize an idea. And one of the things that I've seen over and over again is that my current opinion is that people need to have three beliefs before they will proceed with something that they haven't done before or a new idea. Number one, and this is the one we skip, that it's possible in principle. I could see why that would work. We skip right over that one and try to backfill it with why it's possible in practice, right?
Mm.
And so focusing on why something's possible in practice, which is here's how you use it, here's what the features are, here's what the benefits are, whatever, is like, okay, but if I still don't understand or I can't intuit or I intuit something different than what you want as for why it's possible in principle, that's not going to work. And oh, by the way, I might tune out because I am actually not going to like effort enough to try to figure out what the heck you're trying to tell me about this. And the third one is that it's got to be worth it. And this is where I think we over-indexed a little bit.
The
on
outcome.
Purpose. It's because, yeah, it's got to be worth it, but it's not just the outcome. There's another element to worth it. And that is what I refer to in the second book, Say What They Can't Done Here, as the effort to outcome ratio, right? Or you can think about it as the expense to outcome ratio, which is, I may really want that, but that is way too many steps. Or I may really want that. Can I cheekily say, this is where like nobody does 75 hard for more than 75 days, if they ever get there. Because it's like...
Was the cost-benefit analysis. It was
exactly,
like a cost-benefit.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
And so this is where, again, A, there's a believability problem when it's ball bearings are not going to get world peace. And then second, there is that kind of, okay, but like the practicality of it, what would it actually require for some of these businesses in order to be able to do that? A lot of them were not able to put their actions where their words were. A huge reason why I started all of this work in the first place, because I started out in marketing and branding, was that I would see that gap between the message and the lived experience that people were having, right? And yes, United Airlines is my favorite punching bag for this because, and I've recently, somebody from the marketing department of United Airlines was in one of my talks. So I was like, this is fun. But the thing, it's a great example of if there is any kind of gap, right? So it's great if there's no gap between my recalled or lived or my awareness of experiences with United Airlines and the up to recent tagline, as she informed me, of Fly the Friendly Skies, not apparently the tagline anymore. If there's any gap there, my memory is going to overtake whatever message you have said. And the fact that there was a gap between what I believe to be true about that brand, what it means to me, and what the words were, now erodes my trust in future words from that brand.
Right.
If there's no gap, you're good, fine, which is great. What did you want? And so I looked at that as a marketer and said, okay, well, I can either be continually creating gaps because my leadership or whatever wants to put out this aspirational language about what is all possible, or I can find the power in what we already do so that we are articulating the strength of the actual action. And honestly, that's where it all started. And now where it's landed, right, is deep into human reasoning and process theory and argumentation and about how, even at the organizational level, there is a, I always think of it as like a prime or even a primal theory about what we do and why. Nobody does anything without the belief that it might work.
You have to start there. You have to start there.
And so we have to understand for any company, whether it's their current or individual, whether it's their current behavior or a future thing they want to do, we have to be able to surface and decode why they think it might work or why you think it works. Because the fastest way to get somebody else to see why it might work would be to explain that. And that's really where I've ended up with my work, is that the red thread was kind of the first foray into that. And it still works. And then, you know, my current work is just an even faster to really get at that kind of prime philosophy. Because once you got that, well, then you can build the red thread, that kind of prime narrative around it to say, okay, well, now this is how that kind of operating philosophy actually plays out in the context of the world so that we can understand what that looks like in practice. So yeah, it's been a journey.
Tabitha, I feel like we could go on forever. We had no doubt. And really, listeners, please go grab the books. It helps put your ideas in such a actionable way for anybody to grasp and take the action that you want them to take. If Tamsin, I have one question for you. If you could put, I'm going to go old school here, a sticky note on every thinking leader, professional, anyone that wants to communicate an idea that's really important to them, put a sticky note on their laptops and on their monitors. Mm. What would it say to remind them of the conversation that we just had, Tamsin?
Share the rationale. And I mean that from a both share it, but also share it, right? But share the rationale. That is really like, it's, and not just the reasons, the rationale. It's that system of beliefs. And again, I shorten it for memorability to it, but if, then, because, and. If we want this, then we need to do this because this is true and this is true. And is there more detail? Yes. But share the rationale. And that's a really good place to start because I think there are, consider it like a meaning-making Mad Lib. And most of us have at least three blanks.
Tamsin, thank you so much. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. What fun.
If you remember one thing from this episode, it's this. Your idea might not be bad. It's just the way that it's packaged. So if you have a message that you want to share, use Tamsin's method, the red thread. It's genius. If you want to go deeper with Tamsin, find her books. Say What They Can't Unhear. Find your red thread. They're all linked in the show notes. And hey, if you have gotten any value at all, any way to make your message crisper and more tight, please leave a review and testimonial. It's going to help us bring in experts like Tamsin to help us influence anyone. Until the next time, my friends, change behavior, change lives. Take care.